Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and I've got an interesting program for you to start the show. Before the First World War, the United States was a very different place, especially for women. And our first guest today is Amy Stewart. She is the New York Times bestselling author of 9 books, including Girl Waits with Gun and the rest of the Cop Sisters series. They're based on the true story of one of America's first female deputy sheriffs and her 2 rambunctious sisters. We're going to be talking with her about the latest in the series. The latest book is called Miss Cop's Midnight Confessions. And in it, she tells about what life was like for some girls 100 years ago here in the U.S. Are you a fan of the Cop Sisters series? What would you like to know about Amy's research into that time? I hope you'll join our conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org, or you can also post on Facebook. And while you're there, check out the new Ideas Network Facebook page. We'd love to have you do that and like that one as well. And let's welcome Amy Stewart. Amy, great to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's good to talk to you.
You know, you and I have talked a couple of times before this. We talked in 2011, if I'm not mistaken, that you came out with the book Wicked Bugs, which was a lot of fun.
Yes.
And then again in 2013 when you wrote The Drunken Botanist.
I know. We have a history.
We have a history, but I tell you what, these are pretty far removed from writing about female sheriffs. Talk about why you went from one to the other.
Well, you know, I had been wanting to write fiction. Fiction, mostly what I read for pleasure, is novels. And there are a couple of failed novels in drawers in between all those nonfiction books. So it isn't as if I hadn't been trying. I had. But I found this newspaper article about the Cop Sisters from 100 years ago, just by accident, as you do when you're doing research. You know, you're looking for one thing and something else turns up incidentally in the margins. And I was immediately fascinated. But, you know, this happens every day when you're doing research. And I sort of have a file of, well, that's interesting. Maybe I'll come back to that someday. But in this case, I stopped what I was doing and spent the rest of the day and actually many months to follow trying to figure out who these women were and why no one's ever heard of them. And I knew immediately that it would make a great novel, and not just one, but many novels.
Yeah, for sure.
Here we are.
Well, for those who aren't familiar, tell us about the Cop Sisters.
So in 1914, these 3 unmarried sisters were driving into town in Paterson, New Jersey, and they got in a car wreck. They were in a horse and buggy, and a guy in a brand-new automobile ran them down. And that incident led to them being harassed by this guy. They got into all kinds of disputes. They were the target of arson attempts, kidnapping threats, shots fired at their house. I mean, they basically just got into a car crash with the wrong guy. But that was such a high-profile crime at the time that it led to crazy amounts of media attention. And the eldest sister, Constance, who was 35 at the time, was actually issued a gun and helped the sheriff catch the guy. So she became a pioneering woman in law enforcement. I'm not giving anything away because it's right on the cover of the book, but he made her a deputy sheriff as a result of what she did, which is unheard of in those days.
Yeah, really. Do you relate to her the most of all the sisters?
I do. You know, so here's the thing about Constance. At that moment in time, like I said, she was in her mid-30s. She was unmarried. She had no interest in marriage or children. She really wanted a career, but, you know, you couldn't really go to college if you were a woman. A lot of education was closed to women. And the things she could have done, her mother didn't want her to do. So she had a really tough time getting any kind of education and any kind of job. She was also a large woman for her time. She was 6 feet tall, weighed 180 pounds. And this is before World War One, so a man was 5'7", 5'8", at that time. That was on average. So I think in a lot of ways, Constance really felt like a misfit. And we can all relate to feeling like a misfit, yeah. right, in one
yes.
way or another. But in her case, she took this, what could have been a tragedy, you know, this violent crime, and she turned it into a really powerful, transforming moment in her life and sent her life in a direction that I'm sure she could not have ever envisioned for herself.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's really fascinating to read. I love the book. I really enjoyed reading it. What kind of research did you have to do to find out about the sisters and their story?
Well, you know, I started with the easy stuff. A lot of old newspapers have been digitized, and you can subscribe to a few services and find a lot. Fortunately, they were covered in the papers quite a bit, because anything a woman did that was straight outside her lane at that time got coverage all over the country. So even if that paper in New Jersey hasn't been digitized, there's a paper in El Paso that picked up the story, and I can read it there. So I did that, and I did their family history on Ancestry.com, which is, you know, genealogy, census records, and all those kind of documents. I hired a genealogist in New Jersey to go into courthouses and get things that she knew how to get that I didn't know how to get, like birth certificates and property deeds and death certificates and wills and things like that. And then, of course, I've been back and forth. I live on the West Coast, but I've been back and forth to New Jersey quite a bit to visit the places where these events happened and to go into the basement of libraries and get the microfilm for all those newspapers that are not digitized, and to interview people. So, I mean, local historians help me out a lot, walking around little towns and talking to someone who really knows the history, but also family members. I have tracked down descendants of this family who have been so generous and have shared stories and have been not at all freaked out that a complete stranger is writing novels about their amazing aunts.
Well, I tell you, it's really cool. And you use real, I mean, events are fictionalized in a way, but based on real events, and you use real people's names.
Yeah.
Were you concerned about using real people and their names?
It was the only way I wanted to do it. You know, what I'm trying to do here is to tell the true story of what happened to these three sisters over the many years that they were living under one roof as unmarried adult sisters and working together. They will go on, as you will see, they go on to work in law enforcement and crime fighting and detective work for a good long, they had a good long run as a result of this car accident. And so I want to tell that whole story over a series of novels and depend on fiction when I don't know what happened and I need to fill in gaps, but otherwise use what really happened to anchor them in place. So even little peripheral characters are true to life. A lawyer who might only have a scene or two is a real person, and in some cases I have also tracked down the family of that lawyer, and I have photographs and I have documents, and I, you know, so I really am trying to dig in, and I'm very wedded to this true story. I'm very wedded to telling in as real a way as I can how these three women managed to remain so independent and to just figure out who they were at a time when, you know, we weren't even citizens. We didn't have the vote yet. We didn't have full citizenship. And how did they manage to stand on their own two feet and make their way in a world that didn't want that for them?
You know, I think, and that's one of the things that really struck me about the book. I kind of, you know, knew about these instances in a way about how women were kind of treated then, but it really struck home when I read your book.
Yeah, there's lots of little things, and these are issues that I've thought about for a long time. So, for instance, in the 1910s, we were just coming out of an era where women were the legal property of men in a very literal sense. Women could not own property because we ourselves were property. And so, for instance, in the 1800s, if your husband died and he owned a bakery, you could not own that bakery. Some man would have to be found to own the bakery, and the widow hopefully would get some income out of that, but no one had to do that. So we were nearing the end of that era, but, you know, that era didn't really end until much later. When I go out and talk about this book, there's always women in my audiences who remember that in the early 1970s, women could not get credit cards in their own name or a business loan. You know, a husband had to sign for those things, had to come down to the bank and sign off. I had a woman come up to me after an event and say, you know, I had a hysterectomy in 1972, and they wouldn't do it till my husband signed a permission slip. So that's recent. That's my lifetime, and I'm sure your lifetime as well.
Oh, for sure.
Right. So, you know, things were very different then. I'm reading newspapers from 1914 every day now, and the want ads are jobs for men and jobs for women, and those are two separate columns in the paper.
Oh, man. How did you decide when to use your creative license with the people and the events? Were you when you were stuck or...
Yeah, well...
What did you do?
I know. Everyone who writes historical fiction draws the line in a different place. And for me, what it is if it really happened, it stays in the book. And I use fiction to sort of explain and justify these events that otherwise stand alone, that I sometimes don't know, well, what led up to this, or why did they do that? So I'm only using fiction to fill in the gaps between the facts. But there are a few cases where I change something for my own convenience, and I always explain it. I always put in the back of the book where I veered away from real life. And the biggest example is in the first in the series, Girl Waits with a Gun, I realized very quickly that four women under one roof was just beyond my pay grade. In real life, the cop sister's mother was still alive in the 1910s. And I killed her off a few years early. I sent her to an early grave because I just could not figure out the dynamic between the four of them was so much easier after she was dead. So my apologies to Mrs. Kopp that she died prematurely.
Well, and I should mention, since you mentioned the Girl Waits with Gun, that, as the first book in the series, is going to be featured on our own Chapter a Day program starting on October 2nd, as you well know.
That's what I know. I'm so excited about that.
It will definitely help interest in sales of that particular book. I can give you that for sure, because none of us ever is able to listen to every chapter of Chapter a Day. And well, you always want to know, well, I want to read the rest of the book, so that's kind
of.
Well,
I'm gonna tune in. I'm gonna listen to the whole thing.
We have some really good readers, so I think you're going to enjoy listening to it. Well, and this is the third in your series, as we said. What about the inspiration for the events in this book?
Yeah, so in the third book, so this is Miss Kopp's Midnight Confessions. This is the one that just came out last week. And by this time, Constance is a deputy sheriff, and she's really on a roll. She's really running things. She's in charge of the women's floor of the jail. So sort of think of, you know, Orange is the New Black of the 1910s. There she is running that ward. And she's doing some real law enforcement. You know, most early police women did not have a gun or a badge or a club. They did not have arrest authority, meaning they could not arrest a criminal if they witnessed a crime taking place. But Constance had all of that, and she was paid exactly the same as the male deputies, which is unheard of at that time. So she's doing great. And the cases that came before her in early 1916, and these are real cases, were two young women who are arrested on what would have been called morality charges. So at that time...
Edna and Minnie.
And so at that time, parents could go to the police and say, my daughter is wayward. She is incorrigible. She is morally deficient. You should put her in jail. And that was happening. And those girls had no right to an attorney. This is long before, you know, if you cannot afford an attorney, one will be assigned to you. That didn't exist. So they had no representation and were sent off to girls' reformatories, sometimes for years at a time, on very thin charges. And so the one case that came before her, this girl, Edna Hustis, was 18 years old and just moved out of the house to live in a boarding house and work at a local munitions factory to make ammunition for the war, which was, of course, going on in Europe at that time. And her mother called the police on her, and Constance intervened. So that's one case. And another case, which is a little bit more alarming, was a teenage girl who ran off with an older man. So she was arrested for what in those days they called illegal cohabitation. You can get arrested for living with someone you weren't married to, and people were. So the theme of that novel is sort of how women were locked up at that time for crimes of a romantic nature or crimes of just a woman being out in the world and trying to be independent could get you sent to jail.
It is absolutely amazing. Amy Stewart is our guest today. She is the author of the Cops Mystery Series, three of them. Her latest is called Miss Cops Midnight Confessions. Maybe you've read one or two of her books. Maybe you have some questions about that time. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we talk to the author of a new cookbook that features recipes made with einkorn flour and less refined sugar. So I hope you can stay with us for that. Right now, having a lot of fun talking with Amy Stewart, a New York Times bestselling author of 9 books, including Girl Waits with Gun, and her latest, Miss Cops Midnight Confessions. Again, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. David in Menominee has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, David.
Hello. I have to say my partner and I are huge fans of this lady and her work. My question is concerning the sheriff who hires her. We would love to see a red-hot romance coming up between the two of them. And did he really exist? And is his wife the pill that she seems to be?
There you go.
Those are all good questions. Let's see. So Sheriff Heath was a real person. And I know less about his wife, although I have reason to think that their marriage was unhappy. However, you know, what's interesting to me about his wife, Cordelia, is that she was in a tough spot. You know, it's not easy to be married to someone in law enforcement anyway, because their lives are in danger every day, and it's frightening. Also, in those days, the sheriff was required to live at the jail. So she had to give up her nice house and move into the jail and live basically in the jail's basement with her children. And I've been to that jail. I've been in the apartment where they once lived. There's no park for the kids. There's no neighbors. It had to have been really rough. So she's unhappy. And, you know, I'm so interested in her because, in a way, I don't think it makes her awful. Like, I think she wanted something different from her life than what she got. And as for the question of whether or not Constance and Sheriff Heath should have a romance, you know, this comes up a lot with book clubs. I do a lot of Skype chats with book clubs.
Well, it crossed my mind.
Well, right, but so here's the question is, does Constance want a boyfriend? You know, in those days, you didn't really have a boyfriend. You either sort of got married or you didn't. And she said very clearly in interviews that she had no interest in marriage or children. And Sheriff Heath, who's very progressive, very principled, in real life, he fought hard for Constance, and he defended her against critics and defended the need to employ a woman at a time when very few people were doing that. But, you know, does that make him a good husband? You know, one of the things that you start to see with Sheriff Heath and his wife a little is that he might be very progressive at work, but when he comes home, he wants dinner on the table, and he wants his shoes shined and his shirts ironed. And he doesn't really talk to his wife about his job because she didn't want to hear it. It's sort of terrifying for her, and maybe he doesn't like her input. But Constance, he sort of connects to on a professional level. But would that make him a good husband for Constance? I sort of question that. And also, I don't think she wants a boyfriend. You know, at the end of Girl Waits with Gun, and again, I'm not giving anything away because it says right on the cover that she becomes a deputy sheriff, but I wrote a scene where she gets offered that job, and when I was writing it, it felt sort of like a scene where the girl gets the kiss. Like, it had this sort of bubbly happiness to it, only instead of getting a kiss, she got a job, which is what she really wanted.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think on that. You know, the hilarious letters. There were letters proposing marriage to her.
Yes.
That you write some. I don't know if you wrote those letters or if you took those letters from history, but they're hilarious.
Yeah, I had fun with those letters. Unfortunately, I do know that she received marriage proposals. So she would do something brave and amazing, like chase down a crook and throw the handcuffs on him, and that would make the papers once again all over the country. And every time that happened, she would get a lot of letters in the mail, including marriage proposals. And what I did to write those letters is I just searched newspapers of the era and other records that I could find for just records of odd marriage proposals. And I read a lot of old letters to try to get the language right. I actually have a letter written here in Northern California from about that time period of a man writing to propose marriage to someone. And it is sort of hilariously awful. Like, the thing with all these letters is these are not proposals anyone would want to accept. No woman would go, oh, yeah, this sounds like a great deal.
I tell you, I laughed out loud when I read a couple of those. They were really, really funny. But David, thank you for calling. I want to give Cindy in Elk Mound a chance to join us. Cindy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for putting me on. I wanted to make a comment. My grandmother was born in 1898, and she told me that when she was a girl, they were not considered proper for girls to read newspapers.
There you go. Right.
Yeah, don't read the newspaper. Now, you wonder what the reasoning is. What would have been, in your mind, Amy, what would have been the reasoning behind that?
Well, you know, I mean, I can really see in a family that newspapers are that's how we find out about affairs of the world, which is not a woman's concern. So I can, you know, there would have been plenty of families at that time who thought that novels led to sin and waywardness, and, you know, that novels were not proper reading for young women either. So, I mean, women's lives were very, very constrained at that time, and what was an acceptable and appropriate activity for a woman, it would have been really a lot of housework, a lot of cleaning, you know, some church activities, and really not much else. And the Kopp sisters definitely were feeling that.
Yeah. Cindy, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. I would love to hear from you. Kathy on Facebook says she and her daughter enjoy reading fiction that is based on real people, so I'm pretty sure she's going to like your book. She mentioned another author, Elliot Roosevelt, and I don't know if you know that author or not.
Oh, no, I don't. I will go looking for Elliot Roosevelt.
Yeah, that's worth a look. What appeals to you about this time in our history?
Well, what I like about the 1910s is that we're not yet in the modern era. We're sort of still in the 1800s in terms of dress. Dress was still very Victorian. Obviously our social norms, everything we've just been talking about, is still very Victorian. And also, we're starting to see a new era creep in with disruptive technology, and it's sort of fascinating to me the similarities between then and now. You know, cars were just starting to get out on the roads, and what that meant is that roads had to change. Like, roads could not handle automobile traffic, and every county was trying to decide what roads to pave with new paving and which ones to leave for horse and buggies, and you needed a map that showed you what roads you could take your car on, because you couldn't take them on all of them. So, you know, you think about cities now today talking about, well, what are we going to do about driverless cars? So in so many ways, telephones and other things, technology was starting to disrupt how we did things. And it's also a really interesting time politically. I mean, the anti-immigrant sentiments that I read about in the 1910s are shocking, not because they're so outdated, but because they're so familiar.
Yeah.
So it's a really intriguing time in history. The 1920s we know a lot about. We see the 1920s on TV all the time. we're all sort of familiar with the imagery of the 20s, but the 1910s we don't talk about as much, so I'm really intrigued with that time period.
Yeah, and the Mann Act and how it was interpreted in the early 1900s, it goes along with some of the things you've been talking about, but go back to the Mann Act for us for a minute.
Yeah, so the Mann Act was passed in about, I want to say 1907 or 1908, and that's M-A-N-N. It was named after the senator who proposed it. And this was, with all good intentions, meant to be an act to combat sex trafficking. And it's still in force today, but it's been changed greatly. Well, the problem was that the Mann Act made it illegal to transport a woman across state lines for an immoral purpose. So This is exactly what one of my real-life characters actually got caught for, is that they were living in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and they would take the ferry over to New York City, and that meant they were going across state lines. So suddenly you're in hot water for transporting a woman. In fact, when I went to the Hackensack jail to talk to the sheriff's department, today, and to get a tour of the old jail where Sheriff Heath lived and worked, they very proudly pointed me to their mugshot of Frank Sinatra. Sinatra as a young man, and you can look up this mugshot. It's a wonderful photograph, and they're so happy to have it. They were the ones who arrested him for transporting a woman across state lines for an immoral purpose. So this law hung around for a while. And was used for all kinds of very flimsy prosecution of men and women for silly reasons.
But men wound up getting the better of the deal pretty often, did they not?
Pretty often, right, because they could afford representation, so they had better lawyers and were maybe able to cut better deals. And also men were not considered to be in need of reforming for their moral crimes. It was, thought to be sort of inevitable that, of course, men are going to do whatever they can get away with. But a woman who, went and spent a night with a man she wasn't married to, she was considered in need of correction. So she had to go to a reformatory and be changed so that she would not do that anymore. And she was also considered a threat to the health of able-bodied men. We had no good treatments for sexually transmitted diseases at that time, and we were about to join World War One, and everyone knew that we were going to go eventually. And so women were seen as a health threat to our healthy young men who were going to go off and fight.
We have Keith in Wausau with a question for you, so let's go there. Keith, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have a question for your author. I'm a history major from college. I taught history for a while and consider myself a semi-average historian. My concern is, although I really enjoy historical novels, and I've not read any of yours, although I think I might very much like them, my concern is when does an average reader become confused about what is history in fact and what is in fact fictional history? And I think of authors like Gore Vidal and recently Ken Follett, who do a wonderful job with historical fiction, but do take some trespass on real facts to create their story, and thus help to create the myths about history that are not true.
Hmm. Interesting question. Amy?
Yeah, I think that's interesting, too. And so one of the things I do is I do put historical notes and sources at the end. And I didn't even realize that novelists don't do this with historical fiction very often. I did it by habit because it's what I did with all my nonfiction books. So I do try to explain the differences and also some of the historical context. But, here's the thing, that's fiction for you, and not just historical fiction, but modern-day fiction as well changes things. That's what novelists do, is they create their own world. I'll never forget David Sedaris quoted, he in one of his short stories, he had a shrub that bore fruit in the spring, little berries in the spring, and somebody pointed out that no plant bears berries in the spring, they come in the fall. And he said, it's fiction. If I wanted to make fruit in the spring, it's going to make fruit in the spring. And I just thought that was hilarious, because I would have considered that a step too far. We need to be at least horticulturally accurate here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And I did appreciate that last chapter in your book as well, where you explained, where you kind of cite sources and explain what may have, or where you got information that was not exactly correct with what happened to the Kopp sisters.
Right. So, for instance, one of the things I decided not to do, because it was driving me crazy, was to figure out where the trains run and what the train timetables were at the time. If Constance needs to get on a train, she just gets on a train. And so railroad buffs in New Jersey have said to me, you know, there wasn't a stop at that station that year. Say, you know what? We're going to just have to let that go.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, you know, The youngest Kopp sister has a flair for the dramatic, and in this book she takes off to travel with performer Mae Ward, who was kind of an interesting and a real person.
Mae Ward is a real person. She was a vaudeville actress who Constance Kopp, the eldest Kopp sister, had a real run-in with in 1916, and what I did is I sort of filled in an elaborate backstory about what led up to that run-in that involved the youngest sister, Florette, who really does want to be on stage, and that was also true of Florette. So it made sense that Florette would be drawn to Mae Ward and would want to get into that world a little bit. The amazing part about that story is Mae Ward and her husband, Freeman Bernstein. Freeman was her show business manager. They're fascinating characters in their own right. And when I stumbled into their story and realized what was coming next for them in the 1920s, I knew that I wanted to get them in as characters in this book and keep them as recurring characters in the series because they're so interesting. Then I found out that Freeman Bernstein's grandnephew has written a biography of Freeman.
Ah.
Walter Shapiro, who's a very well-known political columnist, is the grandnephew of Freeman Bernstein. So Walter and I have been in touch, and he told me, he said, when I was writing about my great-uncle Freeman, I found the Kopp sisters, and I thought somebody should write a book about them. So he and I have actually gone and done some events together. He wrote this, the thing that Freeman Bernstein's real claim to fame is that he tried to swindle Hitler right before World War II. So Walter wrote this book called Hustling Hitler about his crazy great-uncle Freeman.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
Real people and amazing, fascinating, hilarious people.
Well, I tell you, the kind of the side story, well, no, it's not a side story. Part of the story of your book with Edna and Minnie, and they do come together near the end of the book.
Yeah.
I thought that was a fascinating story. And to me, I was thinking, boy, if she writes another book, I wouldn't mind her writing one about Edna and Minnie and their
exactly.
adventures following.
Right. Well, I've been reading a lot of novels written in the 1910s, and there are a few great novels about, and nonfiction as well, memoirs about people who got caught, and especially women who got caught up in the war and wanted to go to France before the U.S. actually entered the war. So what I have, Edna is working in a munitions factory. She's working at the DuPont Powder Plant Works in Pompton Lakes in real life. So I have her sort of getting caught up in this war fever and really wanting to go to France and volunteer early, which you could do through the Red Cross. You could go into Canada. You could go into the U.K. and go with a volunteer group. And so, yeah, in some ways, this even as I was writing it, I was thinking, this sort of feels like the prequel to their great adventure. So
yeah.
I know, I have been thinking about that, and many people who have read the book so far have said to me, I want to know what happens next to those two once they get to France. So I have to figure out, how do I do that? How do I tell that story?
Yeah, I hope you do, because I'll be looking forward to reading it for sure, because I thought they were really, really interesting people. Are you continuing to write this series? That's another question I had.
Oh, yes. Number four is finished. I just turned it in. And when I get finished with this book tour and get home in November, I'll be starting on number five. And I hope there will be many more to come. If people keep reading them, then I get to keep writing them.
Yeah, I would hope so, because they're sure a lot of fun to read. And if you think about your own putting together of these books, what's the favorite part of it for you? The research, the writing, the interviews with public radio?
The interviews with public radio is always the best part. Even better when I can be there in person. I am a public radio junkie, so I love going to all the stations around the country. But really, the most amazing part has been meeting the family. Florette, the youngest cop, her son is still alive. She was the youngest, and she had a child later in life, which is why he's even still with us. And sitting down with someone who personally knew one of my characters, you know, you have to understand, like, in some ways these women are very real to me, but in other ways it feels like I made them up. So the fact that I can sit down with a living, breathing human being and ask questions about the characters in my novel and get answers that are far better than anything I ever could have imagined, that's a day I'll never forget, the first time I sat down with him. He not only had a lot to say about his mother, but his Aunt Norma, the middle cop sister, who we haven't talked as much about, but he's the one who told me what Norma's personality was like, and he brought her to life in a way that I never would have. It would have never occurred to me to make Norma the kind of difficult, disagreeable, obstinate, judgmental, harsh person that she is, but I love her so much for all those things.
Oh, and you have her raising pigeons in this book.
I do, which is fiction, but you know what? It turned out that in real life they had a bird. They had one of those big African parrots that live for so many decades. So I imagined that Norma raised birds, and then I found out later that in real life they had a bird, just a different kind. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, this has been, as it always is, Amy, I always enjoy talking with you. It's been a lot of fun. And good luck with Miss Cop's Midnight Confessions. Are you in Wisconsin at all for readings? Probably not.
I will be. We're actually working on that. So stay tuned.
And what about your page? Where could we go to learn more about you?
Yeah, go to amystewart.com or find me on Facebook. There's lots going on, or just anywhere. Any, you name it, I'm on it. Social media wise, I'm there.
Well, Amy, I look forward to your next visit. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Amy Stewart, New York Times bestselling author of 9 books. The first in the Cop series was Girl Waits with Gun, which, by the way, was the title was taken from an actual newspaper headline, and that was the headline. And she used that for her book. And that book is going to be read on Chapter a Day. It's going to be featured on Chapter a Day, and it will be starting on October 2nd. So we certainly look forward to I'm looking forward to hearing and listening to Chapter a Day for that one as well. Amy Stewart, the author of Miss Cop's Midnight Confessions. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with another author who has some recipes for you. She's put a book together involving a very ancient grain that you can use in your baking and cooking. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.